Hey everyone, Brian Brown here. I have an episode for you that's taken from our recent Imagination Redeemed conference. It's by Heidi White and it's called The Art of Christian Memory. This session, the video from it, and the video from every other session from the conference is available now on the Anselm website. You can head over to imaginationredeemed.com to buy a ticket to access all of it. If you're an Anselm member, head over to anselmsociety.org and log in because it's available to you for free. Honestly, I highly recommend if you're not an Anselm member, just joining as a member because you get cool stuff like this with as much regularity as we can pump it out. So this session is by Heidi White. It was one of our plenary sessions from the weekend. The Art of Christian Memory. So these days we tend to take a dim view of the past. We struggle to overcome the things personal or corporate, that we wish we could go back and undo. But Christianity teaches a different way of viewing the past, one in which remember is one of the most frequent commands in Scripture, in which gratitude is a discipline rather than a feeling, and in which nothing is outside the reach of Christ to redeem. Heidi did some interesting stuff with this when she looked at several different stories from mythology to explore a posture that can enable Christians to be conservers of goodness and beauty that they've inherited and restorers of things that have been broken. Enjoy.
So I'm going to begin, as I am wont to do, with a story. The oldest Greek mythologies tell the story of Zeus, the father of gods and men, and his lover, Mnemosyne, the goddess of memory and language. And the story goes that Zeus visited Mnemosyne for 9 consecutive nights, and in due course she gives birth to 9 daughters called the Muses. And the Muses become the goddesses of art and learning. It was the Muses that invented music, astronomy, philosophy, geometry, grammar, rhetoric, poetry, painting, sculpture, architecture, and more. And they were so delighted by their own creations that they inspired mortals to create in imitation of their divine abilities. And if you think about it, the analogy of this is rather straightforward, but also quite profound, as all profound things are probably both. The union of God and memory creates art. And memory has always been the fundamental ground of being of all art and culture. What we remember makes us who we are on 3 levels: individually, communally, and spiritually. Even destructive or revolutionary art, which I'm not always a fan of, but just sometimes necessary, but even that is based on memory insofar as it revolts against it. And sometimes that is also necessary in order to expose and eliminate from an individual soul, a culture, or our spiritual lives, something wicked or oppressive. So memory is at once individual, communal, and spiritual. And on all 3 of those levels, memory endures mainly, think about your own memory, in images and narratives. And indeed, memory almost always enshrines itself in myth. Let me explain what I mean by that. There's an author called David Hicks, and he wrote this masterful a treatise on Christian classical education called Norms and Nobility. If you're at all interested in education, like run, don't walk to get a hold of this book. And in it, he makes a distinction between 2 fundamental modes or ways of knowing. One he calls logos, and the other he calls mythos. So logos is the rational way of knowing. And mythos is the imaginative way of knowing. Let me read you a quote from the book. He says, quote, "The mythos represents man's imaginative and ultimately spiritual effort." Do you hear the connection between imagination and spirit? Let me read that again. The mythos represents man's imaginative and ultimately spiritual effort to make this world intelligible. The logos sets forth his rational attempt to do the same. So mythos then becomes the basis of imaginative work. Music, literature, art, poetry, dance, and the like. And logos then becomes the basis of rational work. The sciences, theology, philosophy, the systematic analysis, categorization, and logical working out of ideas. However, I want to be really careful in making a distinction here, and Hicks does the same thing in his book. They're not intended to be pitted against one another. These two ways of knowing belong together. They are two threads in a tapestry that makes a complete picture. But modernity, the era in which we live, wants to pit them against each other, wants to tear them apart, right? Logos is the only way of knowing. Mythos then becomes relegated to the background, right? The only thing that mythos is really good for, the imaginative way of knowing, is propaganda, entertainment, or a syllabus. And before we get too smug about this, Christianity is not exempt from this. Most of us have been conditioned from within the church to see the faith as logos and not as mythos. Or, for those who are savvy enough to see a problem with this, it swings the other way. The faith is entirely mythos. It's just a metaphor. Right? I was listening on the way here, actually, to a recent interview with Jordan Peterson, Douglas Murray, and Jonathan Pageau. Did anybody listen to this interview? It's fantastic. It's a very, very interesting. Jordan Peterson's always just so fascinating to me because he's so smart. The Canadian psychologist, right? He's such a smart guy. But what he keeps trying to do is have all of the benefits of the Christian ethic without actually believing it as logos. Do you know what I mean? He wants the benefit of the mythos without accepting it as logos. And so the acrobatics that he makes are like so fascinating to me. Whereas there's Jonathan Pageau, like, yeah, I believe in the resurrection. And so it's easy. Right? And so it's just in modernity, there is kind of still this, even within thoughtful intellectuals, on the Christian and the secular side, there's still kind of this fundamental assumption that those two ways of knowing don't belong together and cannot be reconciled. But this division is an utterly false and diabolical dichotomy. Christianity is at once rational and mystical, intellectual and imaginative, true and beautiful. Through Christ, in him, all things hold together, Colossians tells us. Through Christ, the historic Christian faith is the nexus and the union of all knowledge that comes from logos and mythos. And the Renaissance of the Christian imagination is reclaiming the vital and essential nature of mythos in the intellectual and the artistic realms, which of course belong together. And this doesn't mean that the faith is a myth in the sense that it is a lie or a metaphor. Rather, Christianity is a mythos or a myth in the sense that it is a meaning-making, truer story that ennobles and forms the soul to human flourishing in this world and the next. Another quote from David Hicks from Norms of Nobility. He says, "A good myth, like a good map, enables the wanderer to survive and perhaps even to thrive in the wilderness." And this has been the project of myth from the beginning of time until now. And Hicks does indeed write very specifically about education in his book, but his ideas extend beyond their immediate context. And indeed, he addresses that in the book. He says that he invites us to what he calls the pursuit of a Christian paideia. And if any of you are familiar with that word, you know that it's the Greek for both education and culture. There wasn't a distinction in the ancient mind between the education of a person and the culture in which that person becomes human over the course of their life. Education is both an individual endeavor for each individual and also a communal endeavor of culture, because each individual grows up within a defining culture that tells them who they are and who they ought to become. So education and culture is the same project in the ancient mind, and it ought to be so today. And I say this, I know I'm not speaking to a room of educators, which is who I usually speak to. I'm a Christian classical education consultant and teacher. And so I talk a lot to educators, but in talking, this is a delight to talk to a room full of people who are culture builders and culture keepers. As I said earlier, a person, and this, Paul, you alluded to this last night. We haven't even met. Hi, Paul. I'm Heidi. It's nice to meet you. You alluded to this last night, that a person is a microcosm of the whole world, right? I am a world that has been created good and then fallen and must be redeemed by the incarnation of Christ. And I participate in his death, burial, resurrection, and restoration. That's the same for you. It's the same for the whole world. A person is a microcosm dwelling within rings of three concentric circles. And each individual self exists in the smallest innermost ring, right? Surrounded farther out by a society, a communal society with its normative way of life, and surrounded still further out by the universal circle that is the realm of eternal things that surrounds and encloses us. It was G.K. Chesterton that calls them the permanent things. I really love that. Things that endure from culture to culture, which is why we can read an ancient myth, the myth of the Odyssey, for example. Odysseus on his journey home. And although that was millennia ago, it still speaks to us because the myth makes sense of the permanent things. Things like holiness, goodness, truth, beauty, justice, suffering, death, love. And to the ancient mind, paideia was the whole package, all three circles passed intact from one generation to the next. And that remains our project today as participants in the Renaissance of the Christian imagination. This is a lost idea and it ought to be reclaimed. In the Republic, Socrates argues that the city is like the soul. Both proceed from pre-existing forms. Do you hear the three circles? The soul, the city, the forms. And therefore, he says, we ought to rule our cities and our souls by the standard of the eternal good. Which is pretty much exactly what Jordan Peterson was saying, right? Just the question of what makes that eternal good is enduringly relevant, right? Socrates' unified vision for the virtuous life articulates the basis for ancient paideia, right? Paideia offers a meaningful, unified, normative being in the world. It instills how to live individually, communally, and spiritually. Unlike the pagan version of Paideia, however, the Christian Paideia has the benefit of being true. Socrates articulated a hope, a shadow, as Lewis might call it. But Christ fulfills that ancient vision. And developing and preserving a Christian Paideia is the beating heart of any meaningful renewal of the Christian imagination. David Hicks writes that it is, quote, for the world's fight, the second circle, and the soul's salvation, that inner circle. And this is this twofold mission, the world's fight, the soul's salvation, is the telos, which is Greek for the purpose, the goal, the ultimate end of Christian creative effort for both creators and beholders of Christian art and culture, and secular art and culture. And in a sense, then, mythos becomes nearly always just the point of not only my talks, but my vocation in the world as an educator. Many of you are artists, and I admire that so much, and continue to learn from that. I'm really just more of a teacher. I was telling Matthew Clark the other night that my, like, what I do is I don't like make the thing, but I'll like I just see myself as like, look at this. Look at this. Look at this amazing, beautiful thing. Don't miss it. I want to demonstrate why and how we cultivate a culture of mythos, of meaning-making stories. In our interior and exterior lives, in our homes, in our classrooms, in our studios, in our galleries, in our bedside tables and conversations, gatherings, and the food that we eat, the way that we approach the world as a Christian Paideia. Lewis called the Christian story the true myth. I would love that. So we can think of other stories, pagan stories, ancient stories, as sub-myths, right? Tolkien said that we're sub-creators. So all of these lesser stories, so to speak, are all an attempt to get to the big story. And because of that, they unite us with this thread of humanity across the ages. This is true for all forms of art. But I'm going to specifically talk about storytelling, and because I think it's generally much more powerful to show rather than to tell, I'm going to tell you four ancient stories, classical stories. Three of them are pagan stories, and one of them is a Christian story. And I will tell the story and then make some remarks about Christian creative efforts. So the stories I'm going to tell you today all center around, as I'm sure you're guessing right now, a weaving woman. Why weaving? Right? Well, it's a really good question. These women are Arachne, Helen of Troy, Penelope, and Mary, the mother of our Lord. But why weaving? Well, that's a really good question. Weaving is one of the oldest crafts in human history. Every culture in the history of the world has a rich weaving tradition. In ancient times, all women wove across the board. This was women's work. And weaving wasn't just practical or useful. It certainly was. That's how you got clothes and cloths and tapestries and everything. But it was also beautiful. This wasn't a craft that wealthy women would pass on to their servants. It was a craft that all women did. The greater the lady, the greater the weaving. Even the goddesses wove, as we will see today. Weaving women have always made the world, both literally and figuratively. They wove the clothes on their backs, the textiles for everyday use, They wove the tapestries depicting the stories of their cultures on the wall. Greek women and Trojan women, we see in the old stories, would weave the robes that their husbands or their fathers or their brothers wore into battle. Their weaving kept them home. Crafting, practicality and beauty in the inner sanctums of their families and their lives. Their weaving was necessary for survival and also necessary for more. It was necessary for relationship, for communal culture, for family culture, for worship, for conversation, and for hospitality. And thus, weaving a tapestry was and ought to remain, I think we have to recover a vision for this, more than crafting an artifact. It was the building of an entire culture. Children would grow up watching their mothers weave. Little girls would imitate their moms, and the boys would honor them. And so weaving is a fitting metaphor for culture building and culture keeping. Just as ancient women meticulously wove their artifacts, trying to make it as beautiful and useful as they could and as enduring as they could, because weaving is a temporary art. It's not like a clay tablet that's going to endure for hundreds of years. Weaving crumbles away. And so in order for it to last, it had to be of a higher and greater quality. And women would receive back from their own hands and from their relationships and in their households the beauty and the usefulness in proportion to the investment that they put into each artifact. So in the heart of every ancient home was a weaving woman, weaving not just cloth, but life. And weaving women made their homes, their families, their culture, and the world. And so, of course, weaving women became part of the enduring record, the stories of their cultures. Myths are full of weaving women. And so today I'm going to tell you about four. But this is, of course, a metaphor for life. It isn't just for women. It's for all of us. So the great temptation, let's talk about Arachne. Many of you probably already know her story. The great temptation of any artist, really any human, is the temptation to abandon divine glory to weave for our own glory. Another thing I noticed from Paul's talk last night is that, and I'm just putting a dot, dot, dot on this. This is something that was brought up by your talk in connection to knowing what I was going to talk about today. And just, there's somehow some kind of connection between time and glory. To talk about one is somehow to talk about the other. And maybe it has to do with that spiraling upward of creation that we talked about. But I'm putting a dot, dot, dot. I'm kind of like thinking about this as a result of this connection that I made. So the artist's temptation is often to weave for our own glory and to abandon divine glory. And there's an ancient story that addresses this kind of weaving. It's the story of Arachne, which you can find in Ovid, he's much later than the Greek writers. He wrote in Latin. He was a Roman author. And he wrote a book called Metamorphoses, which perhaps you can tell if you know the etymology. You can probably tell every story. Some of them are just like half a page, and some of them are a little bit longer, but every story in Metamorphoses is about a transformation from one thing to another. So Arachne was a peasant girl. She was neither wealthy nor powerful, but she was prodigiously skilled at weaving. So in a culture in which women wove and weaving was king, she was like the LeBron James of weaving. Or you know, the Joanna Gaines. Maybe this is that audience, I don't know. But she was so skilled in her art that she fancied herself as proficient as Athena, the goddess of war and wisdom. And since wisdom includes craftsmanship, that's something to think about, Athena was the greatest weaver in the universe. Ovid tells us that Arachne boasted of her mastery of the craft in public in her village, claiming to be better than Athena herself. A challenge. So Athena appears to her and all disguised as an old crone because she noticed the girl's skill and revered it, but she also noticed her impiety and desired to correct it. So she disguised herself as an old crone and paid a visit to the boasting girl. And she praised Arachne's skill, but chided her for her disrespect, reminding her to honor the gods. And she told her to be content with being the best of mortals, but not to challenge the gods. But scornful Arachne tossed her head and she says, quote, "I do challenge her. And if I lose, there's nothing I would refuse to pay. As for your wonderful goddess, where is she? Why does she dodge the challenge I have offered?" End quote. She is here. Do you hear these old theophanies? They echo the Bible, don't they? I am. She is here, says Athena, throws off her disguise and reveals herself as a goddess. Now, theophanies, that's the appearances, sudden appearance of an or revelation of the presence of a god, often killed mortals in ancient stories. But Athena doesn't want to kill Arachne. She wants to correct her. So she says, all right, challenge accepted. Arachne glowered and stared her down. She's not intimidated by the goddess. So they engage in a weaving contest. They're like, ready, set, weave. They like set up their looms and they're like, go to the public square and everybody's like gathering around. So Athena's tapestry is a warning to Arachne. It contains images of the glories of the gods in punishing overreaching and arrogant mortals. Arachne's tapestry, on the other hand, is a direct challenge to the glory of the gods. She, and to the folly of the gods, she filled her tapestries with images of male gods seducing mortal women. And when Athena and Arachne complete their tapestry, something really interesting happens. And this is what takes this story, I think, to a much deeper level than it could have gone. And the text says, neither Athena nor the goddess Envy herself could find a flaw in Arachne's work. Arachne's work was so skilled, so beautifully woven, that she rivaled the goddess. But that wasn't really the point, was it? The disrespectful content of her tapestry brought judgment upon her. Athena was so enraged at her irreverence that she struck Arachne on the head with her shuttle, but she doesn't destroy her. Here, I'm going to read you this like really vivid description. Quote, she sprinkled her with hellbane, and her hair fell out, and her nose and ears fell off, and her head was shrunken, and her body very tiny, nothing but belly. And with little fingers clinging along the sides as legs, but from the belly she kept spinning. The spider has not forgotten the art she used to practice. Athena turned Arachne into an arachnid. And to this day, Arachne continues to spin, and her webs are very beautiful, very skilled, but entirely empty. Human effort has always been prone to irreverence and impiety. Form and skill are only half the story. This has always been, and it always will be, because what we make is a reflection of its maker. A shallow and disrespectful soul will produce nothing but empty webs, however skilled. And as artists and audiences who are Christians, who desire to participate in the life of the world, can you think of a more horrifying judgment than to be condemned to be good at what you do, but to make nothing meaningful and enduring? And yet Arachne exists in every generation. Just turn on HBO. Those are some really, really skilled shows. But they are empty webs. She is proud, arrogant, skilled and prolific, but superficial, weaving for her own glory, resisting the gods. And what's really interesting about Arachne is that her story is now really alive and well, and now she's often portrayed as a hero. The whole point of the story is to condemn her impiety, right? But many contemporary critics claim her as a feminist icon, displaying the sins of the patriarchy and betrayed by the gods. Empty webs catch flies. Arachne continues to spin empty webs, catching the attention of an empty and bereft cultural landscape whose entire point is to undermine and destroy what is good and true and beautiful. Don't be Arachne. Now, this is perhaps a very avoidable temptation in this crowd of people, but it's worth bringing up. There's another type of weaving with a much more subtler temptation that I want to bring up. This is the weaving of Helen of Troy. She's the wife of Menelaus, king of Sparta, whose brother Agamemnon is the leader of the Greek kings. Now, Aphrodite has promised Paris to give him the most beautiful woman in the world. So that happens to be Helen. She's married and actually pretty happily married to Menelaus in Troy, in Sparta. But what is that to a goddess? She sends Eros, or Cupid, her son, to shoot them both with arrows while Paris is on a diplomatic mission to Sparta. So the two fall in love and run away. And end up back in Troy, where Paris is the prince of Troy, and then Menelaus, of course, cannot stomach the insult to his manhood. And it seems, you know, this is debatable, that he really loves his wife. Actually, their marriage is one of the most ambiguous and saddest personal relationships in the Iliad and the Odyssey. Anyway, he goes after her, and then they start a 10-year war that we call the Trojan War. And out of that comes these two great epics, the Iliad and the Odyssey. Now, it is now, at the beginning of the Iliad, it's 9 years into the war. All epics begin in media res, in the middle of things, right? And so Helen remains pretty much chained, in a metaphorical sense, to Paris's bed. She finds Paris irresistible, but is constantly tormented by what she's done. She feels very deep shame. And when we first meet Helen of Troy in book 2 of the Iliad, she is, dun, 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 weaving. Here's the quote. It says, quote, "Now to Helen of the white arms came a messenger, Iris. She came on Helen in the chamber. She was weaving a great web, a red folding robe, and weaving into it the numerous struggles of Trojans, breakers of horses, and strong-armed Achaeans, struggles that they endured for her sake at the hands of the war gods." In this scene, Iris has come to deliver a message to Helen, who stands at a loom, weaving stories from the war into a robe. She's going to give the robe probably to Paris. As the war rages outside her chamber window, she contemplates the chaos and the destruction through creating something from it. So far, so good. That's the vocation of art. As she weaves, though, she weeps and she talks about herself and her own suffering to anybody who will listen to her. Her weaving serves nobody but herself and her lover. She is entirely self-centered, always enclosed within herself, speaking of nothing transcendent, nothing hopeful, only her own suffering and her own grief. And guess what? It's valid. She suffered greatly. She might have suffered the most of anybody in that war. It was being fought over her, in which she is essentially a slave. But her art offers nothing but her own suffering. Later on, after Helen returns to Sparta with Menelaus, we find her weaving again. Odysseus goes on his long, this is in the Odyssey, goes on his long journey. He stops in Sparta. Oh, no, this is Telemachus, not Odysseus. Telemachus' son, that's Odysseus' son. He's going to find his father. He stops in Sparta to question Menelaus. When was the last time you saw my father? Where's he been? And as is due to a great guest in ancient culture, they invite him to a banquet. They bring him into the banquet hall where Helen is weaving, surrounded by her servant girls. And as they talk and tell stories, which is another part of their culture, an essential part of their culture, the men telling stories over a meal, they both begin to weep, Telemachus and Menelaus. They weep over grief of lost Odysseus. And Helen can't handle it. Let me read you from the text. Quote, "Now Helen, who is descended of Zeus, thought of the next thing. Into the wine of which they were drinking, she cast a medicine of heart's ease, free of gall, to make one forget all sorrows. And whoever had drunk it down once it had been mixed in the wine bowl, for the day that he drank it, he would have no tear roll down his face, not if his mother died and his father died, not if men murdered a brother or a beloved son in his presence with the bronze, and he with his own eyes saw it. Such were the subtle medicines Zeus's daughter had in her possessions." End quote. Helen's art is the art of forgetfulness. The tapestries we weave, the lives we build, the content and form of the art and culture that we offer are powerful. They're so powerful, but Helen forgets hope. And because she forgets hope, she creates art that does nothing, but is nothing but self-indulgent and forgetful. She neglects the truer story. She puts nothing in her art but pain. She erases or forgets redemption. So whether we see Helen as a wicked temptress or a trapped victim, and the debate is hot on each side. If you're, you know, these are the things that you're, if like you're a classicist, you like lose sleep over. There's no doubt that she is sad and that she has suffered and that she is skilled. But she forgets hope. Suffering is not too much for us. We have an eternal hope. We don't need art to forget, but to remember. In fact, we must remember, because through art we tell the truth about our world. The fall is real, death is real, but so is resurrection. So is the coming restoration. It's that spiraling up of creation again that's moving towards something. This is not a sinking ship. And our art ought to reflect that. We ought to be honest about the darkness, but also about the light. So our third weaving woman is Penelope, the wife of Odysseus. This is my literary hero. All I want to do is be like Penelope. In Homer's epic, the Odyssey, our hero Odysseus is on a journey home. And when the epic opens, Odysseus, who's the king of Ithaca, has been gone for 20 years, and he left behind his new bride and his newborn baby son to go do his duty and fight in the war. So Odysseus is trying to find his way home, and he has a protector in Athena, Poseidon, the god of the sea, is really mad at him for reasons that are explored in the stories, and that's really bad because the only way to get to an island is over the sea. So he is in trouble for most of the epic. And Odysseus would have been dead long ago if not for Athena, his protector. And the story is the story of Odysseus's homecoming to Ithaca, to his wife Penelope, and their son Telemachus, who does not know his father at all. But Penelope has not forgotten him in 20 years. Usually middle-aged women and men are not the topic of great love stories, but the Odyssey is your story. Penelope has no idea if her husband will ever come home, but she does not want, she doesn't want to marry again, but she must, right? She's caught in this impossible situation. The epics, the Greeks loved impossible situations. They just were like, what kind of like double bind can I put my characters in? So here's Penelope's. So she is, on the one hand, if Odysseus is alive, she must wait for him. However, if he is dead, she must remarry and bring political stability to Ithaca. And her home has been overrun with 200 suitors who want her hands, but they're not like sweet, they're awful. They eat Odysseus's meat, they sleep with his servant girls, they drink his wine, they plunder his palace, and they're courting his wife. Most of them are young men whose fathers are away at war. So, although she is the queen, and she is a formidable and prodigious leader in her own right, but although she is, right now she's just a woman in a house overrun with dangerous men. Odysseus must come home, or she must learn whether or not he is dead or alive. So, in order to escape the advances of the suitors, Penelope, who is often called wise, circumspect, quiet Penelope, invents a clever plan. She tells the suitors that she is weaving a shroud for her father-in-law, Laertes, who is sick and weak. He's not dead, but he's sick and weak with longing for his son to return. So she tells the suitors, I must weave a shroud that is worthy of my father-in-law before he dies of grief. And even these jerk-faced suitors are so moved by the virtue and the wisdom of this plan and this endeavor that they're like shamed into saying like, okay, take your time, whatever you need, okay? So Penelope, every day in the great hall, every day, she weaves with her servant women, she weaves the shroud. It's beautiful, it's skilled, it's lovely. And then every night, after everyone is asleep, Penelope sneaks downstairs and unravels every strand. So the shroud is never done. 3 years later, the suitors are like, wait a second. So, the story of Penelope and the shroud is repeated 3 times in the Odyssey. Threes are always important, right? Which means that it's not a quaint little detail, but a crucial aspect of the narrative. Why? Over the centuries, many scholars and commentators and readers have noted the Christian allegory embedded within the narrative pattern of the Odyssey. Now, this is really remarkable because the Odyssey was recorded or written down by Homer in about 800 BC, before, 800 years, nearly a millennia before Christ was born. And it was almost certainly part of a much, much older oral tradition. So the Christian allegory thing is like, right? So, but here's the allegory. I think of Penelope all the time in the context of art and culture. I think of her weaving and unraveling as she waits. In the Odyssey, Penelope, the bride of the king, is stranded in her own home, surrounded by dangers and temptations, awaiting her lord and lover to return. The suitors are vying for her hand, but they don't love her. They only want to possess her, to lure her, to seduce her away from her true husband. They are dangerous. They will harm her, and they plot in the story to kill Telemachus, the next generation. The Odyssey begins at the point when the suitors are tired of waiting and are forcing the issue. So in every way, Penelope is like us, stranded in our own beautiful but now dangerous home, surrounded by dangers and temptation, unsure if and when we will be rescued. So while we wait, what do we do? Clever, faithful Penelope came up with a plan. She could not save herself, but she could take action in the waiting. And what was her action? To make something beautiful. To weave a meaningful artifact from within her culture that transcends her culture because it is for a higher purpose. This, again, is just like us. We, too, are creators and beholders. We want our art to endure. If you're an artist, you know that. You want your art to endure, to pass on. Penelope skillfully wove a tapestry with many threads, right? This beautifully woven shroud. And in the making of that tapestry, she participates in the salvation of herself, her culture, and the whole story, the whole cosmic story, the spiritual realm. There's those three circles again. We weave, we create art and culture just for the same reason that Penelope does, to participate in the waiting in this generation. But what do we make of the unraveling? This is the question that plagues artists who are paying attention to the fact that we live in a fallen world, right? The unraveling, though, and here's the thing, is part of the point. It is part of what makes her virtuous, and it is part of why she is remembered. Penelope unraveled her work herself, not because it wasn't good. It was. And not because it wasn't worth doing. It was essential. She unraveled her work because the work was not for herself or for her own glory, but for Odysseus. When the time came for her work to be established permanently, and I'll address that in a second, when it was time for Laertes to die and to be buried with a beautifully woven shroud, she would have it ready, but not yet. And even then, it was a shroud. It was going to crumble away in a grave. In every generation, artists and culture makers, culture keepers, parents, educators, thinkers, we weave and we unravel. I hate to break it to you, but the work of most of us is not going to endure and maybe even not be very widely known. And even if it is, even if you end up being a Da Vinci, a Shakespeare, a Bach, right? Even then, how many people are just like running all over themselves to listen to Bach in the car on the way to work, right? Some of you are. Good job. You should. You should totally do that, right? But pop culture is always going to trump high culture in the minds of ordinary citizens, right? That's going to happen. They are misunderstood and dismissed often, those whose work endures. This is hard for me, kind of an achiever type. Every time I want to do something, I want it to be like the best thing that's ever been done, and I want people to notice it. I really like glory. God forgive me. But interestingly enough, this too is another prominent theme, and maybe the theme of the epics, and I alluded to this earlier, is glory. The Greek word for glory in the Iliad and the Odyssey is kleos. And kleos is the question, the conflict, and the dividing line of everything in the epics. Everybody is thinking about glory, right? Penelope, though, is thinking about the glory of another. None of the other epic heroes are thinking about themselves. This is why Penelope is the true hero of the Odyssey and why she is my true hero. And it's alluded to directly within the Odyssey. And Penelope's glory is in the unraveling. That is why she is remembered, is because she didn't insist on the glory of her own work. In ancient times, kleos, glory was, this is what it was, because they didn't believe in a meaningful afterlife, right? You die, you go to the underworld, but you become a ghost, nothing but a vapor. It's really kind of an overwhelmingly despairing idea. But this is why the Greek heroes would fight so hard, right? This is why war and battle was so important, because the way that you would earn glory is by what people said to you about you after you were dead. So what does the Odyssey say about Penelope now that she is dead? What is her kleos? What is her glory? I'll read it to you. This is Agamemnon, the ghost of Agamemnon in the underworld, speaking to the living Odysseus, who has come down on a journey into the underworld. He beats the ghost of Agamemnon, whose own wife, Clytemnestra, betrayed and murdered him along with her lover. So he says about this Agamemnon, who's dead because of his wife, says to Odysseus about Odysseus's wife. He says this, quote, "O fortunate son of Laertes, Odysseus of the many devices, surely you won yourself a wife endowed with great virtue. How good was proved the heart of blameless Penelope, Icarius's daughter, and how well she remembered her wedded husband." End quote. And then he says this, "The immortals will sing for the people of earth a thing of grace in the song for prudent Penelope." Some scholars say that this thing of grace, this song of prudent Penelope, is the Odyssey itself. And if that is the case, we do well to pay attention to her wisdom. Anyway, we Christians know more than the Greeks, right? We know that our glory is not in what other people say about us after we are dead, but in what God says to us after we are dead. The ancient and the medieval church taught that the pilgrimage of our life on earth is to be made fit for heaven. So when we arrive at the top of that great mountain and enter into true glory, will God say, "Well done, good and faithful servant, how well you remembered your wedded husband"? Every generation needs its Penelopes. You are the Penelopes of this generation. May we be prudent and faithful. May we weave and allow it to be unraveled, sometimes by our own fingers, for our kleos, for our heavenly glory. May God remember us in his kingdom because we remembered him here. So the fourth and final weaving woman, I'm going to try to go as quickly. How long do I have? Like now?
-12 minutes.
Okay. You went a long time with the singing.
I know.
All right. I'm just going to own this. All right. That's our final one, and I am going to go through this quickly, but I cannot skip Mary. Fourth and final weaving woman I will present today is Mary, the mother of our Lord. So there are thousands of ancient extra-biblical texts that speak about many, many things. And one of them is the Proto-Evangelium of James, which the scholarship on this text is hotly debated. And it really does have this lilting quality of legend. So I don't have to introduce any pagan stories with any kind of disclaimer, like I have to give a disclaimer about my story about the life of Mary, which that makes me sad and speaks to why we need mythos. This text does have this quality of legend to it. And you'll hear it when I quote from it here in a couple of minutes. So I'm not making a claim of the veracity of the historical biography of the life of the mother of our Lord. But I am giving you this text as an essential, I believe, piece of mythos in the Christian story. According to the text, Mary was the beloved daughter of Joachim and Anna, who was a devout and childless couple. And they both prayed and prayed for a child. Childless women, by the way, are a big, big part of myths. And Joachim went out to the wilderness to pray, to ask God for a child, and Anna stayed home. And she prays like this. I want to just read you this prayer. It's so lovely. She says, "Oh, what am I like?" she prayed as she wept. "I'm not like the birds of the heavens, for even the birds are fruitful before you, Lord. I am not like the unreasoning beasts, for even the unreasoning beasts are fruitful before you, O Lord. I am not like these waters, for even the waters are fruitful before you, Lord. What am I like? I am not like the earth, because the earth bears its fruit in season and blesses you, Lord." End quote. Isn't that so beautiful? What a prayer. God grants her prayer. Joachim receives a word from the Lord in the wilderness when they come when he comes home, they come together that very hour with the blessing of the Lord. Mary is conceived, which incidentally, the conception of Mary is a feast day in the liturgical traditions. And it's December 8th in the West and December 9th in the East. And it reminds us that marital love is holy, fruitful, and righteous. The text tells us that Anna promises to give Mary as an offering to the temple, much like Hannah did with Samuel in the Old Testament. There's a connection there. So when Mary was 3 years old, same age as Samuel, Anna fulfilled her promise to God. They took her to the temple in Jerusalem to live, and the story goes that Mary didn't cry or follow after them when her parents left her in the temple, but eagerly climbed the steps and danced in the altar. And then, quote, Mary lived like a nurtured dove in the temple and received food from the hand of an angel, end quote. When Mary was 12 years old, the priests had to decide what to do with her because she was approaching the age of womanhood. And the law of Moses says that that even a virgin cannot serve in the temple, when a menstruating woman cannot serve in the temple. So they had to figure out what to do with her. By this time, she had a wonderful reputation as a pious young woman, and her parents had died. And so what they did, they prayed to God. Her kinsman Zechariah, you recognize Zechariah, right? Went into the holy place to pray for God's will. And it said, behold, an angel of the Lord stood before him saying, Zacharias, Zacharias, go out and call together the widowers among the people. And the one upon whom the Lord shows a sign, he shall have her as his wife, end quote. So the sign came upon Joseph, an elderly widower, devout, who at first unwillingly received that, saying, I will be the laughingstock of Israel if I take a young 12-year-old girl into my home. And they said, this is the will of the Lord. And then he took her into his home and kept her a virgin so that she could continue to serve in the temple as was her wish and his. And now we come to the part of the story that speaks to our topic, weaving women. This is from books 10 and 11 of the text. It's really short and you can find it in lots of places. You can actually just get it as a PDF online. It says this, after some years, there was a council of the priests and they said, you guys are going to love this so much. It's worth the 10 minutes, I promise. Let us make a veil for the temple of the Lord. So the high priest said, call to me the undefiled virgins of the house of David. And the officers went out and found seven. Then the high priest remembered that Mary was from the house of David and was pure. So the officers went out and brought her. So they brought them into the temple of the Lord. And the high priest said, cast lots here before me to know who will weave the gold, the white, the linen, the silk, the hyacinth blue, the scarlet, and the true purple threads. And the lot fell to Mary to weave the scarlet and the true purple. More on that in a minute. And she took them and went back to her house. And it was at this time that Zacharias fell silent, end quote. So Mary was spinning the scarlet thread that she had taken. And taking a pitcher, she went to fill it with water. If any of you did the walk through Holy Theophany Orthodox Church yesterday, you might have seen this icon in the temple. I look at it every time I ever go to church. It's where I go to church. It has an icon of Mary with scarlet and purple thread with a pitcher of water and the angel. And a voice said, rejoice, favored one. The Lord is with you. Blessed are you among women. Mary looked around to the right and to the left to see where the voice was coming from. And beginning to tremble, she went back into the house and set down the pitcher. It goes on and it tells the story of the Annunciation. So let the story sink in here for a minute. In my church tradition, in Orthodox, we call Mary the Theotokos, the God-bearer. She's a weaving woman who wove the maker of the world in her womb. The connection between pregnancy and weaving is very old. Psalm 139 says we are woven together in our mother's womb. So it is with God. He was woven in the womb of a weaving woman. There is no end to the contemplation of Mary as the life giver and the God bearer. I have a few remarks on the story that are by no means intended to be comprehensive, but rather contemplative. The first is the thread. The text emphasizes the color of the thread many times. The lot fell to Mary to weave the scarlet thread and the purple thread. The scarlet thread is symbolic of blood, foreshadowing the death of the paschal lamb that would be her son woven in her womb. He would die on Passover a little over 3 decades later. Red also emphasizes humanity. In Christian iconography, Mary is always wears red outer garments to symbolize her humanity, and she wears blue inner garments to symbolize her purity and her heavenly nature. Christ is the reverse. He wears blue on the outside and red on the inside. The scarlet thread is a recurring symbol in Scripture. You guys are probably thinking of it right now, right? Seen in Tamar tying a scarlet thread to her twin son's leg, to Rahab's scarlet rope that saved the spies in Jericho. And here, oh, and there's a scarlet thread in the priest's ephod, one scarlet thread woven through. And the scarlet thread foreshadows Christ, and here Mary is spinning scarlet thread. She's a weaving woman, soon to weave the fulfillment of the symbolic scarlet thread within her own womb. The other skein of thread is purple, and purple symbolizes royalty, identifying both Mary, who's a peasant woman, and her son as royal. Mary is often called the Queen of Heaven, and of course, Christ is the Lord and King of the whole world. And at her annunciation, she was weaving with the thread of royalty. I also want to point out what Mary was weaving, and this will be my final point. At the time of the annunciation, she was spinning the thread for the veil to the Holy of Holies. The dimensions and description of the temple veil are given to us in the Old Testament. It's a big square, 30 feet by 30 feet, skillfully woven out of blue, scarlet, white, and purple thread, which embroidered with golden cherubim. It was woven so tightly and skillfully, only the best weavers could weave this, so that it was thick and heavy and strong, and the veil guarded the Holy of Holies, protecting sinful humans out here from the consuming fire of the presence of the holiness of God beyond the veil. The high priest went behind that veil only once a year on the Day of Atonement. And he wore bells on the bottom of his robes and tied a rope around his leg so that if he died from the holiness of God, nobody would have to go in there and get him. The bells would tinkle as he fell and they could pull him out with the rope. This is what Mary was weaving at the time of the Annunciation. In Hebrews 10, we're told, quote, "Therefore, brothers and sisters, since we have confidence to enter the most holy place by the blood of Jesus, by a new and living way opened for us through the curtain, that is his body, let us draw the curtain, that is his body. Let us draw near to God with a sincere faith and with the full assurance of faith." Mary did not just participate in weaving the temple veil. She wove the veil of Jesus' flesh, who is the veil, who is the temple curtain. The veil of flesh that was later torn at the cross. Matthew 27 says, quote, "Jesus," this is when he's on the cross. It says, "Jesus, when he had cried again with a loud voice, yielded up the ghost. And behold, at that moment, the veil of the temple was rent in twain." I love the King James Version. It was rent in twain from the top to the bottom. And the earth did quake and the rock rent. Mary participated in weaving that very veil. And she also wove the man who was the veil. And she saw them both torn for the life of the world. In our church tradition, we have a saying that Mary is an example, not an exception. And I think her life as a weaving woman speaks to that. First, she was available for her great work. Her posture was humble, submissive, but she's not weak. Saint Simeon prophesied that a soul would pierce her own soul. A sword would pierce her own soul. Christ did not choose a weak woman to be his mother. She was strong, she was enduring, she was faithful, she was steadfast. She bore burdens that no other living soul has ever borne before or since. And that makes her posture of humility even more compelling. Second, she was faithful in her humble work. When the angel announces her pregnancy, she's spinning wool, a daily task for ancient women. Right? Yet that small daily task contributed to a cosmic salvation. Not only because she became the mother of our Lord, but because she was doing the ordinary quotidian work of weaving wool for the curtain of a temple. To do the big work is to do the small work. Mary shows us that. And that is how Mary is an example and not an exception. She is in every way the antithesis of both Arachne and Helen. She weaves not for her own glory, but for the glory of God. And in return, she receives glory. And she weaves not for forgetfulness or self-indulgence, but in remembering something greater than herself. And in return, she is remembered. All generations will call her blessed. She is an example to us. She's like Penelope in that she wove a great work and saw it unraveled, but she's greater than Penelope in that she bore and wove within herself the salvation and the life of the world. And we too can weave the life of Christ in ourselves, in our culture, and in eternity. So I invite you to find yourselves in these stories. And I'm going to close with a quote from Lewis in Paradise Lost, in Preface. Lewis didn't write Paradise Lost. That was Milton. This is a quote too. This quote from Lewis in the Preface to Paradise Lost. And he says, quote, "When the old poets made some virtue their theme, they were not teaching but adoring. And what we take for the didactic is often the enchanted." Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast of the Anselm Society in Colorado Springs. Our mission is a renaissance of the Christian imagination. We exist to help Christians remember who they are, to cultivate a deep awareness of their relationship to the great story, and to bring that awareness home to their families and churches. To find out more about us or to become a patron, please visit AnselmSociety.org. Thanks for listening.